Hi there, this is Dan Kilbride. I'm the chair of the History Department at John Carroll University outside of Cleveland, and I'm also the host of New Books in American Studies. As most of you know by now, about once a week we find an author, or sometimes an author finds us, who's written a book in American Studies, and that can mean anything from history, which it usually does on this show, literary studies, public health, science, culture, you name it. Today, we are joined by Jonathan Daniel Wells, who is a professor of history and chair of the department at Temple University in Philadelphia. He is the co-editor of the Journal of the Early Republic, and today we're going to talk to him about his book, Women Writers and Journalists in the 19th Century South, published by Cambridge University Press in 2011. Welcome, John Wells.
Thank you, Dan, for the invitation.
You're very welcome. I have a special soft spot in my heart for Southern history. So I guess as a statement of personal prejudice, take it for what it's worth, but I think Southern history is, and has been for a long time, one of the most exciting, well-grounded, and less crazy areas of history writing. Some of the scholarship on Southern history is absolutely fantastic. Certainly we'd say that about slavery studies. But I also think Southern history has really blazed a lot of trails in gender history and women's history in particular. I think some of the most exciting scholarship in women's history and gender studies has been in the South. And so this book is taking its place within a pretty exalted literary pantheon. So, John, just tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Well, I am, as you said, professor and chair in the Department of History at Temple, and I do 19th century American history with a specialist with specialties in Southern history, the Civil War, and the late antebellum period. Two categories you mentioned, gender and women's history, I would also add the study of class has been really invigorated, I think, by some of the work done by Southern historians. And hopefully I've contributed to that discussion in some small way. I think a lot of the new work on class consciousness, and the economic history of the slave South has really caused us to rethink some of our basic assumptions about the region, particularly in the antebellum period. And my first book, which was called The Origins of the Southern Middle Class, touched on that issue. And then this second monograph on women writers and journalists in the region grew out of that first project.
One of the things I like to ask when we're discussing their second or third book is, there's almost always a relationship between that first book and a second book. Is there one here, and how did you get from the Southern middle class to women writers?
Yes, there definitely is here. I think that's probably common because when you write your first book, you can only include so much material. And there are lots of fascinating stories and angles and new information that strike you that you aren't always able to include in the first manuscript, which usually is limited in terms of the number of words you can have in that book by the demands of university presses. So in this case, I had touched on in the Origins of the Southern Middle Class book, I had touched on some of the women in the South who had edited their own newspapers and magazines. Because when I was talking about the middle class in the South, I wasn't talking about the yeomen, not the what we might call a rural middle class between landless, poor whites who may work in agriculture and planters. But instead, I was talking about more of an urban middle class. And the assumption often is that the South had no real urban regions. But of course, there were fairly large cities in the South before the Civil War, including New Orleans, for example. And there was a small but growing in size and growing in importance middle-class professional and commercial group of Southerners, and that's who I really focused on. So included in that definition of the middle class were people who were doctors and lawyers and merchants, but also people who were active in journalism, early newspapers, the periodicals that were published in the South all throughout the antebellum years. And as it turns out, some of those professionals, some of those editors and early journalists happened to be women. And I knew that there had been some work done on Northern women who edited their own newspapers and magazines in the antebellum period. Sarah Josepha Hale is pretty famous, for example, mm-hmm. for having worked on Godey's and other leading Northern productions. But not many studies, in fact, very, very few, had even acknowledged the existence of women who edited their own periodicals. So I touched upon that a little bit in the first book on the middle class, categorizing these women as exemplars of middle class journalism. And then, there was a lot of stuff that really didn't belong in the first book that was really specifically on these women. And I thought, well, since nobody's done a book length study of black and white women editors and journalists in the South in the 19th century, I would do one.
One of the things you observe in the introduction is that what scholarship there is out there tends to focus on fiction and novel writers and novel readers. And you focus in this book on journalism, you women journalists, editors and writers. How was the content of journalism and its relationship to sort of social conventions different from what you find in novels and fiction?
That's a great question. You're right. There has been a lot of work done on novels by both women and men in the South and in the North in the 19th century. And it's not surprising that historians have focused on them. They're a lot more accessible. Many libraries have copies mm-hmm. of famous novels as well as more obscure ones. But the periodicals that were published are much, much harder to find. A few of them have been digitized by the ProQuest company, for example, which has done a great job of including some Southern productions among their digitized offerings, but nowhere near the number that are available in paper copies in the corners of the South. And it just takes some looking. And what interested me was the more obscure magazines. Many historians, even those who don't really specialize in the 19th century, have probably heard of magazines like the Southern Quarterly Review in the 1840s and 50s, and the Southern Literary Messenger, which was the longest-running magazine in the South from the early 1830s to the early 1860s, and then DuBose Review, which was more of a commercial magazine out of New Orleans. Those three have been mined pretty well by scholars, particularly those of the 19th century South. But I was always more interested in the more obscure productions, the ones that were published in small towns in the South. And what you find is that they're a lot more open and freewheeling than you would expect. There's a lot more talk about gender equality and the intellectual equality between men and women. There's discussions of the place of women's rights in Southern society. So I think there's a lot more to be learned. I think really I just scratched the surface on mm-hmm. The amount of material that's actually out there. In fact, I just recently came across a Baltimore periodical that was edited by a woman under the pseudonym Beatrice Ironsides, which fortunately was a pseudonym, not her real name. But that was a production out of Baltimore in the early 1800s. So there's just a lot of these newspapers and magazines, either women contributed to or women directly edited, that I think scholars could make use of.
You kind of anticipated my next question a little bit in your previous answer, which was about the openness of the South's literary culture. Probably special, what people who maybe historians or scholars, but even just the general public probably has a conception of Southern antebellum Southern culture as one that was sort of had a siege mentality, was very closed, very conservative, very leery about newfangled ideas. How open was Southern literary culture? particularly but not exclusively regarding the issue of women's rights. And what were the limits of that openness? What were the boundaries?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. There were significant boundaries. Nowhere did I come across an instance, for example, in which a woman editor or a woman contributor questioned the legitimacy of slavery. Mm-hmm. So the bounds there were pretty clear. These were public documents. You know, they would be circulated either through subscriptions that people bought through, via the mail, the same way we often get magazines through the mail today. Or they would have been passed around from friend to friend, or they could even be deposited in a school library. So these are very public documents, and it was just as unacceptable to question slavery in the pages of these magazines as it would have been if you had gone up, in the middle of the town square and started denouncing human bondage. So the limits there, as I said, are clear. That just is not permitted. Yet, surprisingly, even given that caveat, these newspapers and magazines could be pretty open in terms of discussing almost any other topic, including women's rights. And while there was no Seneca Falls equivalent in the South, there were a number of women who took public stances through these magazines against gender inequality. Rebecca Hicks, for example, was a woman who edited a newspaper near Petersburg, Virginia, called The Kaleidoscope in the middle of the 1850s. And this weekly periodical was about as bold an advocate of gender equality and women's rights as you would have seen in a standard Northern publication that advocated similar ideas. So it seems to have been permitted. I'm not sure you could argue that it was popular, but it seems to be it had been tolerated, the fact that these women were articulating their radical views on gender equality.
Is there a possible explanation for this? And is it true that generally, women readers would read periodicals intended for women, but also general magazines like the Southern Quarterly Review, the Southern Literary Messenger? But it was probably unlikely that men would read magazines aimed at women. Is that right, or am I wrong about that?
No, I think generally that's true. If a magazine had woman in the title or ladies, like, for example, there was a Ladies Companion that was published in the South, then that was pretty clearly targeted at a female-only audience. Mm-hmm. But we know that women also read magazines like the Southern Quarterly Review because Louisa McCord, who was fairly conservative, actually very conservative, South Carolina woman, wrote for that magazine. So, we know that she was engaged with it. But whether or not there was a gender separation in terms of reading material, the magazines that I came across were often surprisingly open in appealing to women's sense of at least intellectual equality. Mm-hmm. And what I argue in the book is that they started off with these claims to intellectual equality, making the argument that women were just as adept at mathematics or astronomy or any other, what you might call the sciences of or math, as men were, but they just hadn't been given the kind of opportunities for education in those fields that men had been. And they begin with these discussions of gender intellectual equality, and that becomes the basis for their arguments for political equality in the South by the end of the 1800s.
Mm-hmm. This book makes some interesting arguments about similarities and differences in the antebellum and postbellum decades, but the question I want to ask you now is restricted to the pre-Civil War era. And that was, what did women journalists do, if anything, besides journalism? In other words, could a woman practice journalism and make a living, or are most of these women writers and editors doing this as a supplement to an income, or as a very time-intensive hobby? As a related question, how did one become an editor of a newspaper or magazine before the Civil War?
there were all different kinds of ways in which women became editors. Sometimes they became editors by default. For example, Frances Bumpus was a woman who edited a newspaper, sort of newspaper and magazine kind of combination. Oftentimes there weren't the hard and fast separation between a newspaper and a magazine that we have today. But in this particular case, her husband passed away. He was the editor of the Weekly Message in Greensboro. And because she had children to support, she was a widow, she had little choice but to try and continue the magazine / newspaper on her own. And that happened fairly often. It happened to Sarah Hillhouse early on in Georgia in the late colonial period. So one of the major ways that women became editors was simply taking over an enterprise after their husbands had passed away, and they had little other means by which to support themselves and their children. Some of them actually took it on directly as a hobby. Caroline Gilman is a good example. And the word hobby probably is not the best word. That right. diminishes what she was really interested in, which was she was interested in contributing to literary culture and in making a financial contribution to her family. So because she had an interest in literature, she had interest in journalism and periodicals, she embarked on a number of magazines, some of which were designed for children and others that were designed for adults. So there were women who, for lack of a better word, just because of their own interest in the field, decided to do it. And then finally, there are some of the outliers. There are women like Mary Chase Barney, who is, to my knowledge, really hasn't been appreciated by historians, but she's got to be one of the most outspoken political women in the entire antebellum period, let alone the region of the slave South. And she became an editor because her husband was fired by Andrew Jackson under his spoil system. And she was so angry at the fact that her husband had been let go by Andrew Jackson that she wrote a long screed against Jackson's spoil system and his administration. And of course, the Whigs ate this up, and they printed her letter on in pamphlet form and on silk so it could be displayed prominently. And then she started her, after she had written that letter, she started a magazine called the National Magazine. And this was out of Baltimore. It was a monthly magazine, and it was as political as any other newspaper or magazine edited by a man before the Civil War. And she rarely missed an issue and an opportunity to criticize Jackson. So in that case, she was neither a widow, but she wasn't really following necessarily an interest, but she felt like she had to do this to help support her family, vindicate her husband, attack what she saw as the evils of the Jackson administration. So that was the fun part of this book, and to me it's the fun part of being a historian is you uncover these people and their ideas and their work. Whereas they haven't been looked at before.
How did you find them? Just a question about the pure detective work aspect of this. How did you track down these women who were sort of public figures in their time, but are certainly obscure today?
Yeah, good question. ProQuest has now digitized Mary Chase Barney's National Magazine. But at the time I was working on my dissertation from the University of Michigan, we didn't have access to these riches on the internet that we do now. And ProQuest actually had a microfilm series of periodicals that you really have to suffer through the dimly,
yep.
dimly lit and microfilm readings where at the time, I was using an electronic microfilm reader, and you'd press the button, and it would skip over 100 pages in half a second. And then you'd have to go back, try to find out where you were. So it was really tedious. But, you have to have a perverse sense of what fun is to be driven to do this kind of thing. So a lot of it was just trolling through microfilm and looking at these periodicals that folks hadn't seen before or hadn't really seized on as an important topic before. And a lot of it was going to archives throughout the South. The archive in University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, at the Wilson Library is very well known, the Southern Historical Collection. But also the Perkins Library at Duke had a lot of pretty obscure magazines. And even the Clements Library at the University of Michigan had a really obscure magazine called The Southern, and was published in Tennessee in 1841, 1842, which turned out to be really useful because there was this long-standing debate over gender equality that stretched over issues over 6 months.
Wow.
And that, you know, that happened to be deposited by somebody, you know, God knows when or how, at the University of Michigan. So, you know, a combination of digitized sources that are more freely available now in microfilm, tediousness, and, you know, the fun of thumbing through an actual publication that may have survived, you know, the decades. That's how I tracked down these women. But the truth is, it was hard to get even basic biographical information on some of these women. Sometimes they changed their last names because they were married two or three times. And oftentimes, you know, they didn't appear in New York Times obituaries or national biographies or any of the other sources that we can often turn to discover the details of an individual's life. And so it really was hard sometimes to get some information on these people. I'll say just finally on this topic, there were in the middle of the 19th century a few collections of women's poetry and women's essays that were published. And sometimes you could find out information about pretty obscure women who are obscure now, but back in the 1840s or 50s, for example, might have been better known. And so would have been included in an anthology.
Right.
But, you know, even then, it was just usually a cursory paragraph introduction and saying this woman hails from Savannah or,
right.
you know, not much to go on. So,
yeah,
I think if anybody was interested in this further, I think there's still plenty of room to do some more work on these women.
Your answer brought back some just really disturbing memories of me spending just beautiful summer days in a dark room at the University of Florida Library, just staring at microfilm. Good grief. It's a lot of Frisbee and probably good times, vitamin D that I wasted in those rooms.
Yeah, like I said, you have to have a fairly perverse idea of what fun is.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to be driven to appreciate these obscure characters and you know think that you're doing something worthy of all the time you put into it.
Yeah, it helps. Another thing you address in your book that may contradict some sort of conventional wisdom just that's out in the air is the differences between the North and the South. You know, people have a sort of general idea that the North and the South, they fought a civil war. They must have been very different, you know, culturally, politically, socially. And one of the things you do in your book is challenge some of the ways in which we conventionally think of the North and South as being different. How do you do that?
Well, there were certainly significant differences between the North and the South, and the most obvious and of paramount significance is the existence of slavery. And in that sense, Southerners, white Southerners, really did kind of intellectually circle the wagons. As I mentioned earlier, it was just not permitted to question slavery. And there's no real indication that any of these women I write about or many people in the South generally were willing to question the legitimacy of slavery, with or without, you know, making it public. So the differences are important to be sure, and I think you can't really understand the coming of the Civil War without understanding the significance of slavery. But when it comes to other elements of society and culture, particularly in this case, the issue of gender, I don't think there was much difference at all between the gender ideology of the antebellum North and South. And I mean, if you wanted to emphasize difference, you would say, you know, well, look at the Seneca Falls meeting in 1848 and the Seneca Falls Declaration, and you have these focal women before the Civil War in the North, and that's true. And while, at least so far, we haven't uncovered a similar instance of women gathering in a kind of convention format, like the Seneca Falls Convention, nonetheless, one of the major, I hope, contributions of my book is to show that there were women who were just as bold in their advocacy of gender equality as anybody in the North. And it shouldn't be surprising, because it's not as if the North and the South lived in entirely separate, walled-off societies. The late Elizabeth Fox Genovese has a very well-known book called Within the Plantation Household, in which she makes the case for gender differences between the North and the South. The North, of course, having experienced the separation of home and work, leaving women to sort of inherit the domestic sphere while men went to politics and work outside the home. And Elizabeth, the late Elizabeth Fox Genovese, argues that in the South, of course, the plantation was home and work combined. So there wasn't that separation of gender ideology. But that would assume that the only aspects of existence that women on plantations would have been exposed to was those in their immediate surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that women in the South, whether they were plantation mistresses, whether they were middle class or upper middle class wives of professionals, and whether they lived in towns or whether they lived in rural areas, actively read magazines, novels, newspapers that were published in the North. And we know this in a couple of different ways. One is that women, Southern readers, often remarked on their reading, whether it was the latest production from James Fenimore Cooper or Washington Irving or Melville or whatever. They would remark on their reading in their diaries and in their letters, and we have numerous examples of that. But we also know that Southerners, white Southerners, from rural areas to small towns to big cities, subscribed in surprisingly large numbers to Northern periodicals. And the postal records that we have remaining in archives across the country testify to the fact that if you were a Southern woman, say, in Charleston, South Carolina, before the Civil War, you might subscribe to Southern Quarterly Review, you might subscribe to Godey's, you might subscribe to the Saturday Evening Post or a couple other magazines, newspapers, other periodicals that mixed Northern and Southern productions. So the short answer is that women were being exposed to all kinds of ideas coming from all over the place, and that's not even to mention the substantial interest in European productions, which I know is mm-hmm. near and dear to your heart, Dan.
That's right.
But, you know, the Edinburgh Review was very well-known and famous. I just finished an article on Charles Dickens and the way in which his novels and his periodicals were widely read by Southerners. So at bottom, there's a lot more of an interchange intellectually between North and South than I think historians have assumed.
Good. Well, I'll make a mental note. We'll have to talk about Dickens at another time, because I just finished an article too where I talked a lot about Dickens. So,
okay.
I have two questions to spin off the last answer you gave. First of all, you observed that Southerners read a lot of Northern published magazines like Godey's North American Review and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
To your knowledge, did Northerners read Southern magazines like the Southern Quarterly Review?
Yes, they did. They often didn't think they were up to par with Northern production. But we know very well that not just Northern writers, but also European writers read and knew about productions from the South. There's a letter from Dickens in which, right before he comes to America, which he acknowledges having read the Southern Quarterly Review, and, you know, says that he hopes to meet the editor when he comes to the United States. which never happens, of course, because Dickens doesn't go farther south than Richmond.
Right.
But yes, I mean, the answer to your question is that there's a tremendous exchange of periodicals going on all across the country, which we haven't really mapped out and we haven't really appreciated, I don't think, to its full extent. But it means that the sections knew exactly what the other was doing. And because, for the most part, you could exchange magazines for free.
Yeah.
For example, if you edited a newspaper or a magazine and I edited one, we could exchange them free of charge to the postal system. And then, we could acknowledge each other's endeavors. So that kind of spurred on this exchange as well.
Another question regarding detective work, and it's so impressive the way that you found these very obscure magazines like the Southern, which just happened to be by the grace of God at the University of Michigan Library. I think one of the really impressive parts of this book is where you discuss what people read and how they reflected on what they read. And many of these observations are culled from the private diaries and letters, almost all of which are unpublished, existing, in one place, in manuscript libraries. How did you find individuals' reflections on what they read? Did this just require reading just reams and reams of letters and diaries and hoping to find that needle in the haystack?
Oftentimes, yes. So, first of all, I appreciate your kind words about the research, but I relied heavily on finding aids, which are the lifesaver for many a historian. And oftentimes, in the finding aids, a librarian would have noted, this woman in her diary comments on having read Melville and Emerson, for example. And then I would go, and sometimes it was just a list of what they had been reading recently or really a cursory mentioning, which wasn't particularly helpful other than just to sort of reassert the importance of this intellectual exchange between North and the South. But other times it was more extensive, and women commented on their favorite authors and why they were their favorite authors or people they didn't particularly appreciate. So, yeah, it was many years of going through the archives and looking at finding aids and sometimes taking a shot in the dark at a diary that didn't have a finding aid, but nonetheless, looked like it was more than a listing of temperatures for the day, which sometimes, it takes up a lot of diary. I remember also going, I think this was at the historical collection in New Orleans, really it looked like a promising diary from a woman before the Civil War. And it was just this unbelievably detailed account of what her son was doing. On a detailed daily basis, which, is no doubt of interest to her. But in terms of what I was interested in getting at, was of no use whatsoever. So, yeah, there's a lot of swing and misses. But again, the strange sense of fun that one derives from these kinds of projects is what keeps you going. And even if you just hit on, 20% of material as being useful, that's the part that goes into making a book.
Yeah, it's a lot like baseball. If you're hitting 250, you're doing okay.
Absolutely.
One of the topics you touched on in your book is education, which is obviously related to reading and writing and so forth. How did opportunities for women's education and also justifications for women's education change over the long 19th century period in the South?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. This has been something that historians have also stressed as sort of a fundamental difference between North and South, arguing at bottom that there were opportunities for a public education in the North that didn't exist in the South. And it's really, this part is true, that it's really not until after the Civil War that Southern states began to appreciate the importance of elaborate, structured public school systems. But before the Civil War, Southerners sought education for their daughters in many other ways. There were boarding schools, there were community schools, there were all kinds of opportunities for middle class and upper class white women. And again, it just makes sense to qualify this because we're not talking about African American free right. women. We're not talking, obviously, about slaves. We're not talking about even working class white women. We're talking about people who could afford private education. And within those limitations, within those very significant boundaries, it's interesting the extent to which communities embraced their schools for girls and young women. Almost every one of these institutions had, at the end of the school year, and then periodically throughout the school year, public performances. And there would be people coming from all around the region, and of course all around the town in which the college was located, to hear these performances and to cheer the girls and young women on. And Mary Kelly's important book, Learning to Stand and Speak, talks a lot about this as well. And, mm-hmm. and my findings in this book on women writers and journalists pretty much confirms what Mary Kelly was arguing, which is that even though these are not public school systems in the sense that we commonly refer to today, they had a lot of public and community support that was expressed in all different kinds of ways. So there were efforts in the later antebellum period to establish school systems in New Orleans, particularly in the origins of the Southern middle class. My first book, I talked a lot about some of these Southerners who were writing to Horace Mann in Massachusetts, asking for advice on how to set up school systems in their own communities. But particularly as we get into the 1880s and 1890s, the opportunities for white women emerge pretty significantly for public school systems. For African American women, the story is a bit more complicated. There are, of course, almost no opportunities for any sustained education for African American free or slave women before the Civil War. But once the Freedmen's Bureau engages in the South after the Civil War and starts to educate thousands of African Americans, it's just remarkable. It's really impressive how quickly not only literacy spreads, but opportunities for African American periodicals explodes rapidly as well. So for African American women, the clock is a lot later. It's not really until sort of the Reconstruction period, and particularly in the decades after, where they're able to take advantage of their interest in magazines and newspapers. But it happens there also.
One of the things you talk about in your book is what you label sort of literary culture. Sort of what women got out of writing and reading, and you know what it meant for them to be engaged in the sort of regional and national conversation about these various issues. You know, what did women find in these magazines that you discuss? You know, one of the words that often attached to them was eclectic,
mm-hmm.
Which meant sort of a grab bag of different things. What did reading mean to women, and what did they read in these magazines?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, eclectic is definitely the right word to use. And that's different, I suppose, than some of the other magazines that we know well, like the Southern Quarterly Review, for example, which was pretty much a straight line table of contents of very sort of learned essays. The Southern Literary Messenger had essays and reviews of fiction, and they had occasionally instances of poetry as well, including mm-hmm. some by women. And then in 1840 or so, there's the Southern Literary Messenger actually publishes the only example that I know of in the antebellum period, poetry by a slave named George Moses Horton.
Did not know.
Yeah, who was a slave near Chapel Hill in North Carolina. So the women's magazines that I looked at were really even more eclectic than either the Messenger or the Southern Quarterly Review, in that they would have book reviews. Any of the major authors, Melville, Hawthorne, they were all reviewed. The productions of Southern, the Southern novelist William Gilmore Sims, books by women novelists, they were all reviewed in the pages of these women's magazines. But they also would often contain news about domestic life, you know, advice on cooking, for example, mm-hmm. Or on child rearing, or essays on women's education. So they're really fascinating windows, I think. I don't know, maybe I'm the only one who finds this fascinating. But I really do, especially these obscure ones, because a lot of these women, for example, they would have written a letter to the editor, or they would have written a poem, and perhaps that's the only time in their entire lives that they appear in print, this uh-huh. one time. So it's an interesting combination of completely obscure women who are ordinary, you know, just ordinary people, and the work of literary giants at the time, like Dickens. And the same is true for African American periodicals after the Civil War. They're very eclectic. They're magazines that cover all different kinds of topics side by side. And you really had to be able to jump from one subject to another, from history to an article on science to a poem to an article on, you know, domestic life. So that was part of the fun, too. You really get into a window into what people were interested in.
Well, yeah, I think it is interesting. I mean, a lot of what we know about just not just Southern life, but living life is what I guess you'd call intellectual history, as opposed to what you're doing, at least in this section of the book, which is more about cultural history, more about what sort of ordinary people read and understood. I guess it's the difference between reading, in today's day, a specialized chemistry journal, and then reading Reader's Digest, mm-hmm. where you may get, if Reader's Digest even exists anymore, I don't know that, but you might have articles on home economics, cooking, science, you know, what's going on in Syria, all in the same 30-page, you know, bundle of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's really what you're getting at.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and to the extent that it was successful, I mean, that's open for debate, because many of these magazines only lasted a short time.
That's right.
Both productions by men and women, you know, a lot of them only lasted a few issues, some 6 months or a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these are magazines that did not, I'm sure, get a wide readership. And one of the problems is, for all historians talk about Southern honor, very often you see it in the page of these magazines.
Please pay.
Yeah, exactly. Please from the editors to yeah. pay your damn subscription. And apparently that was a real problem, not just in women's magazines, but in, you know, for periodicals all across the board.
True in the North as well, as you point out there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we tend to think of the South as, you know, again, it's got this reputation as this sort of anti-intellectual culture, and one of the pieces of evidence is always dragged out is all those cries from editors, you know, pay up your subscription. But the same is going true in the North. I mean, there are plenty of examples of periodicals that last a couple of months or a year because they just can't make it work.
Yeah, absolutely.
How did women authors and editors deal with the dilemma of celebrity? You know, inevitably, or maybe even on purpose, calling attention to themselves as public figures. You know, why was this a dilemma? And how did women authors and editors deal with it?
Interesting topic, actually, because there was a book by a famous literary scholar named Michael Winship that generally argued that there was a fundamental difference between the North and the South, that women sought celebrity in the North in a way that they didn't in the South. But the truth is that the vast majority of poems, essays, advice, whatever it was, in these magazines, women actually signed their name to.
Hmm.
And the women who edited these newspapers and magazines, they don't hide the fact that they're women. Mary Barney's name appears prominently on the cover of the National Magazine. Rebecca Hicks' name appears prominently on the title page of the Kaleidoscope that she edits in Virginia. So it varied from woman to woman. There were some women who were definitely reticent to have their names in public, and so they would use a pseudonym, or they would publish anonymously, or they would sign with initials. Mm-hmm. But there were men who did that too, and there were more women who actually were quite open about owning their editorship or owning their authorship of particular pieces. I think it definitely varied regarding the individual. Mary Elizabeth Lee, for example, was a poet in Charleston, and she was apparently painfully shy. And she knew Caroline Gilman and her husband Samuel Gilman, who wrote the theme song, the alma mater for Harvard. She knew them well, and she knew some other people in Charleston well, but she was pretty much a recluse as far as I can tell. And she, even though she wasn't part of public culture in terms of being out there in society, she always signed her productions with her name. So we know very well what she contributed. Hmm. And there were other women, clearly Mary Barney is one, but, you know, she's perhaps one of the most obvious examples, but there are also women, both white women before the Civil War and black and white women after the Civil War, who were open in regard to being literary celebrities. There is an African-American female editor after the Civil War named Mary Cook. She uses the pseudonym Grace Ermine. But generally, the friends of these people, the people who lived in the neighborhood, the town around them, they knew who was behind the pseudonym. And then there were other African American women who were openly putting their names on these productions. So it's not true that there was a fundamental difference between North and South in regard to women's reluctance to embrace a literary reputation.
Okay. About the Civil War. What opportunities did it provide for white and black women in the South to publish, to edit, and what did they do with those opportunities?
Well, it was mixed. I mean, on the one hand, the opportunities were limited, not only because people's attention was focused on the exigencies of war, but also because the ability to obtain paper and the ability to get something printed and the cost involved, and not to mention the ability to move things throughout a postal system that had obviously been put in dire straits, meant that there were a great many obstacles to both men and women who wanted to publish newspapers or magazines during the Civil War, but nonetheless they did so. Some of them at great personal commitment or cost. The first African-American production that we know in the South is called The Union, or it was also printed in French. It was called Le Union out of New Orleans. It was a bilingual paper, and I don't know very many people who have looked at this either. There's a well-known book by a woman named Penelope Bullock and some others who have looked at African-American press associations and the history of early African-American journalism in the South who have noted this, but I don't think anybody's done an in-depth study of these kinds of productions. So that came out in about like 1862, 1863. And so despite the obstacles, and of which, as I said, there were many, there were women, both black and white women, who did start magazines during the Civil War. Most of them were short-lived. Most of them lasted only an issue or, you know, a dozen issues. Mm-hmm. But again, that was true. That was true of the period before the war as well.
You know, in American history, we tend to periodize. The Civil War is, you know, obvious. It's a watershed. That's not going to surprise anybody. But sometimes those periods work better for some areas of history than for others. And one thing we call the South in this later period is the New South. What was new about the literary landscape for women in the New South, and what wasn't new? I mean, in other words, to what extent was the Civil War really a watershed in for literary-minded women in the South, and to what extent was it not?
Well, in terms of continuity across the century, there were white women who were active all in every decade as editors of periodicals. So, in that sense, there's a lot of similarity. And in some ways, the women of the antebellum period, the white women who edited their own periodicals, were even more outspoken than their sisters who became editors later on in the century. But there's a tremendous difference between pre-war and post-war South in regard to African-American women's contributions.
Right.
Mm-hmm. As I said, you know, before the Civil War, there are Northern productions, as we know, Frederick Douglass's paper and others. But before the Civil War, there are no magazines that I'm aware of that were edited by African-American women or men. And after the Civil War, we absolutely do see a watershed moment because, as I said, the expansion of literacy, the improved abilities to operate openly, particularly in towns, opens up this amazing literary world for both black and white women. And, black and men and women. And another huge significant difference is the existence of press associations after the Civil War, because there's no such association for women, even white women, before the Civil War. And by the time we get to 1870s and 1880s, not only are there regional and national press associations for both African-American and white women, but there are also a lot of them state organizations that are designed to provide an opportunity for female journalists to commiserate on unpaying subscribers or to compare notes or to improve the standards of the profession. And I wouldn't want to create a Whiggish in the historiographical sense of this sort of march to progress.
Yeah.
But it's true that there are a lot more opportunities for women who are interested in magazines and newspapers in the late 19th century than there were in the early 19th century.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're very careful in that epilogue to say, you know, this is not a Whiggish history of, you know, the progress of black and white women, but certainly there was a lot of progress that was made in that later period. One of the interesting sort of anecdotes you relate in this book is that in 1889, two women, Nellie Bly and Elizabeth Bisland, made a sort of a transatlantic race around the world, compete with the around the world in 80 days phenomenon that was big at the time. What do their travels around the world say about the environment for female professional journalists late in the 19th century?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it says that the opportunities were much grander than they were in the early part of the 1800s. Early on in the book, I point out that there's a couple of young women in southern communities who aspire to be journalists, but realizing that for the most part, their dreams are just that they won't have in reality an opportunity to become actual journalists, they actually handwrite their own periodicals. And, they draw a masthead and they put a fake price on it, and they put themselves on as editor, and they hand draw, pretend advertisements. And it's sad because for many of these young women, that's really all it was, an opportunity to, in this limited fashion, to express their creativity. But the opportunities in the South after the Civil War are much more dramatic. And just one quick example, even if you were a young woman and you didn't have access to, for example, becoming, a journalist in New Orleans or some other big city, there was a craze in the late 1870s and early 1880s of self-publishing. And these were usually small 4 or 8 page little newspapers. And they were the printing presses were advertised in magazines for children all across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And became this craze where boys and girls across the country would buy these presses, make their own little newspapers, and rather than having to hand draw them, they look a lot more professional. They look pretty much like a standard newspaper. So this amateur publishing craze is a later manifestation of what is obviously a pretty intense and widespread desire among both African American and white women, particularly girls and young women, to see their names in print, to find a way to express themselves creatively, to sort of mimic and then expand upon what they saw in the newspapers that their fathers or brothers perhaps were reading. So I think this amateur publishing craze has really been largely forgotten among historians, but was a major component of both early journalism and childhood experience in the post-war period.
So the more things change, the more they stay the same. So self-publishing in the 1890s, and right now we're maybe in another boom about self-publishing with the blogging and everything else that's going around. So that's something that's sort of a mini movement today.
Indeed.
One of the things you describe throughout this book is the relationship between female writing and publishing and women's rights. And certainly in the late 19th century, well, maybe in the early 19th century, discussion of women's rights was more sort of theoretical. It was clear that the women's rights movement was a fringe movement that wasn't going anywhere. But in the late 19th century, it is no longer a fringe movement. That the movement for women's suffrage is one that is clearly gaining steam. How did that play out among women writers and publishers in the South in the late 19th century? To what extent were they in favor of the movement for suffrage?
There are two different things. Suffrage is one thing, and even women who believed in gender equality and intellectual equality of the sexes, many of them did not promote the right of women to vote. But they did. Even if they didn't support suffrage for women, they certainly were open in their advocacy of greater equality for women, and that means equality of opportunity. The importance of educating women on a par with boys, giving women the opportunity to become professionals in a way that they thought previous societies and generations had not been allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you ask a really important question. The Northern story of the rise of the women's rights movement has some pretty clear iconic moments, and I've already mentioned the Seneca Falls Declaration as one of those iconic moments, so that you could sort of trace the history of the women's rights movement and how it came to proliferate. In the South, the story has been a little bit different because we don't have those kinds of iconic moments. And that's why Anne Freer Scott's book on the Southern Lady from Pedestal Politics was so important, because she pointed to the ways in which the women's club movement, women forming associations and organizations in the late 1800s, contributed to the emergence of a women's rights movement in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And Elna Green and others have written excellent works on these topics. What I wanted to argue in this book was that while those were the club movement was important, we missed this part of the story of the emergence of support for women's rights in the South. In other words, that the fact that these women found a corner of public culture that they could contribute to and be active in and be more radical and open than probably anywhere else they could in Southern life, that they seized on this aspect of Southern life and culture to make the case first for gender equality and then for political equality. So I really do think that the history of women's journalism in the South is an underappreciated contributor to the emergence of a women's rights movement in the region.
Okay. So we have taken up almost, I see, an hour of your time. So I have one last question. I know you are a department chair of a big department, and you're the co-editor of an important journal. So you obviously are just sitting around staring at the walls, just waiting for something to do. So what's next for you?
Yeah, it's definitely hard to be productive in your research with those things going on. And I don't stare at the wall so much as I stare at my computer on email for countless hours of the day. But actually, my recent interests have taken me in the direction of the history of the late antebellum North, particularly the history of kidnapping and the fugitive slave crisis before the Civil War. So I'm working on a project that addresses the perilous nature of freedom for African Americans who lived in northern communities like the one I live in Philadelphia. So while I will always remain interested in Southern history, and hopefully we'll continue to publish books and articles in that field lately. And this is the beauty of being a professor, is you can follow your own, particularly a professor with tenure, that you can follow your own interests, and mine have taken me to northern communities of African Americans in the late antebellum period.
Well, good, very, very timely with the release of 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah, it would have been more timely if I had started working on this a few years ago and actually had something to publish right now, but theoretically, it's good timing.
So hopefully, it'll be the beginning of a wave that you can just kind of ride in.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Royalty.
We should all be so lucky.
We should all be so lucky. Amen to that. Well, John Wells, thanks so much for spending an hour with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
So once again, this is Dan Kilbride. I'm the editor and host of New Books in American Studies. We've been talking to John Wells about his book, Women Writers and Journalists in the 19th Century American South. You will find a button that will link you to the Amazon page of this book, and we urge everybody to throw John Wells some royalties.
Especially now that it's on paperback.
Amen. Yeah, let's do that. So, John, thanks very much. And everybody out there listening, we'll see you next week. So long.